Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Mario Ritter and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
United States President Donald Trump said, "We'll have to see," when asked if a planned meeting with North Korea's leader will take place. On Wednesday, North Korea threatened to cancel the meeting between Trump and Kim Jong-un in Singapore on June 12th. It said North Korea is not interested in one-sided negotiations, only meant to cause the North to give up its nuclear weapons. North Korea's Vice Foreign Minister Kim Gae-kwon released the statement on the state-run KCNA news agency. He also criticized comments from U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton. In April, Bolton called for the North to give up its nuclear and missile weapons, like Libya. The U.S. removed sanctions on Libya in exchange for a promise to give up its nuclear program in 2003. 8 years later, Libya's leader, Muammar Gaddafi, was overthrown and killed by rebels. On Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke to South Korean Foreign Minister Kang Kyung-hwa. He told Kang that the U.S. continues to prepare for the meeting. Pompeo met with Kim Jong-un recently to discuss issues, including the planned meeting with Trump. On Sunday, Pompeo said that the U.S. would lift sanctions on North Korea if it agreed to completely end its nuclear program. Kim Dong-yub is a North Korean expert at Seoul's Institute for Far Eastern Studies. He told the Associated Press the North is not trying to undermine the Trump-Kim talks. The North's reaction, he said, is more like a complaint over Trump's way of playing the good cop and bad cop game with Pompeo and Bolton. In 1991, the United States announced that it would remove its nuclear weapons from South Korea as part of an arms reduction treaty with the Soviet Union. The following year, North and South Korea agreed to ban nuclear weapons or efforts to develop them. The nations said they would seek nuclear energy only for peaceful purposes. In 1993, North Korea rejected international nuclear inspectors and said it might withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. As a result, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter visited North Korea, which then promised to freeze its nuclear program in 1994. But later that year, North Korean leader Kim Il-sung died, and his son, Kim Jong-il, took power. In 1999, North Korea suspended testing long-distance missiles in exchange for an easing of some sanctions put in place by the U.S. Then came a period of good feeling in which high-level North Korean officials met with U.S. and South Korean officials. The feeling, however, began to change when President George W. Bush accused North Korea of being part of an axis of evil in 2001. The following year, North Korea admitted that it had a secret uranium enrichment program. In 2003, the North withdrew from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Later that year, the six-party talks became an effort by all nations in the area to deal with the North Korean nuclear issue. The group included the two Koreas, China, Japan, Russia, and the U.S. Tension, however, increased as North Korea tested its first nuclear weapon in 2006. The six-party talks also broke down in 2008 and have not been restarted since then. Officials could not reach agreement on methods to prove the North was carrying out its requirements to end its nuclear program. In 2011, Kim Jong-un became North Korea's leader after the death of his father, Kim Jong-il. North Korea agreed to suspend its nuclear activities in exchange for aid. But the deal ended with North Korea's test of a long-distance rocket. U.S. efforts at diplomacy entered a period of what has been called strategic patience. Under this policy, the U.S. and its partners have increased sanctions on North Korea in an effort to get it to return to negotiations. I'm Mario Ritter.
Army doctors in Texas have successfully transplanted a new left ear on a soldier. The ear was grown in the soldier's lower arm. The procedure is the first of its kind for the U.S. Army. It involved doctors taking cartilage from the soldier's ribs. The cartilage was carved to look like an ear. It was then put under the skin of the soldier's arm to let the ear develop. The soldier, Shamika Burridge, is 21 years old. In 2016, she was in a car accident. She and a family member were driving from Mississippi to Fort Bliss, Texas, where Burridge was based. One of the car's tires burst. The vehicle slid for over 200 meters before rolling several times. Burridge was thrown from the car. She suffered severe head and back injuries and lost her left ear. Doctors later told Burridge that if she had not received such quick medical attention, she would have bled to death. After several months in a hospital, Burridge started seeing a counselor because of emotional issues caused by the accident and its effects on her appearance. The counselor suggested that she go to a plastic surgeon, Burridge said. Owen Johnson is Chief of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery at William Beaumont Army Medical Center in El Paso, Texas. He explained to Burridge the process of a total ear reconstruction. At first, Burridge resisted. She had mostly just considered getting an artificial ear, she said. The idea of total reconstruction frightened her, but she wanted to see what Johnson could do, she said in a story on the Army website. By placing the new ear created by her cartilage into Burridge's arm, new blood vessels were able to form. This will let her have feeling in her new ear once the full process is complete. Burridge did not lose her ability to hear, but her ear canal had closed up from the trauma. Johnson was able to open it again. Burridge now has two more operations left. She says she is happy to be almost done with the reconstruction process. She said, "It's been a long process for everything, but I'm back."
California has become the first U.S. state to approve plans to require newly built homes to include solar equipment. The state's Energy Commission voted 5-0 to approve the new rules, which are to take effect in 2020. The rules will cover most newly built residential buildings up to 3 stories high. The move is California's latest step aimed at reaching renewable energy targets and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. California has set a goal of filling half of its electricity needs with renewable energy by 2030. Officials said they had reached 30% by the end of 2017. The state's governor, Jerry Brown, plans to hold an international climate meeting in September. The Energy Commission said the cost of adding solar equipment to a single-family home would be about $9,500. But the group added that homeowners would save at least $19,000 in energy costs over 30 years. The rules were approved after getting widespread support from builders, utility companies, and solar equipment manufacturers. Robert Raymer is the technical director for the California Building Industry Association. He says the action marks a step forward for the wider use of solar power in the U.S. You can bet every other of the 49 states will be watching closely to see what happens, he told the Associated Press. Solar companies praised the new requirements, which officials have said will likely raise demand for solar equipment in California by 10-15%. Tom Werner is head of California-based solar company Sun Power. He told Reuters the decision was another example of California environmental policy becoming a model for other states to follow. The Solar Energy Industries Association called it a historic decision for the state and the U.S. It estimated the action would produce huge economic and environmental benefits, including bringing tens of billions of dollars into California. California is already the nation's number one market for solar equipment sales. At least 5 million homes in the state are estimated to currently use solar power. But some individuals and groups criticized the new rules. Some legislative and community leaders argued that Californians cannot afford to pay any more for housing in what is already an extremely high-priced market. That's just going to drive the cost up and make California, once again, not affordable to live in, said California Assemblyman Brian Daly. Severin Borenstein is an energy economist at the University of California in Berkeley. He sent an email to the head of California's Energy Commission to urge the state to reconsider its decision. He expressed his belief that it is a mistake for California to approve such a policy instead of centering on efforts to develop large solar farms to produce renewable energy. He said these farms would cost much less to operate. "Every energy economist I know is shaking their head at this," he told the Wall Street Journal. "In many ways, this is setting the wrong example," he added. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Theodore Roosevelt was President of the United States during the early years of the 20th century. He was a forceful leader. His national policies led to social reforms and federal protection of nature. His foreign policy led to greater American involvement in world events. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt.
In 1903, Panama declared its independence from Colombia. 15 days later, Panama and the United States signed a treaty. The treaty gave the United States the right to build a canal across Panama. To protect the canal, President Roosevelt declared greater responsibility for a wide area around the canal. The greatest responsibility was financial. Roosevelt said the United States would guarantee repayment of loans made to Latin American countries. He did this to prevent European countries from using the issue of non-payment as an excuse to seize new territory in the Western Hemisphere.
Some Latin American nations were in serious economic trouble. Venezuela was one. At that time, Venezuela owed millions of dollars to Britain and Germany. The Venezuelan ruler refused to make payments on the loans. Britain and Germany decided to use force to get the money. Their ships began blocking Venezuela's ports. When they began shelling coastal areas, President Roosevelt intervened. He urged them to let the International Court of Arbitration at The Hague settle the dispute. They agreed, and the blockade of Venezuela ended.
Less than 2 years later, a similar financial problem arose in the Dominican Republic. Revolutions and dictatorships there prevented repayment of foreign loans. The United States offered a solution. It would take over collection of import taxes at ports in the Dominican Republic. 45% of the money would be paid to the Dominican government. The other 55% would be used to repay loans. The Dominican Republic agreed. The plan succeeded. Some countries in Latin America and the Caribbean questioned the right of the United States to act as policemen for the Western Hemisphere, but none openly opposed President Roosevelt's policy.
Theodore Roosevelt had become president after the assassination of President William McKinley. He completed the last 3 years of McKinley's term. Then he was ready to be elected in his own right. Republican Party leaders, however, were not so sure. Roosevelt had made businessmen angry because of his attempts to control big companies. But he made voters happy because of his fight for social reforms. Roosevelt's only serious competitor for the nomination was a longtime senator and presidential advisor. But the man died before the nominating convention. So Roosevelt won the nomination easily.
The Democratic Party, in the past two elections, had nominated a progressive, Congressman William Jennings Bryan, as its candidate. This time, the Democrats chose a more conservative candidate. He was a New York judge, Alton Parker. Judge Parker had no chance to win the election. Theodore Roosevelt was the best-known man in America. He won easily. On Inauguration Day, Roosevelt made a short speech. He said, America's capitalist economic system had done much good for the country, but it also had created a crisis in social relations, and the crisis had to be solved. If we fail, Roosevelt said, the cause of self-government throughout the world will suffer greatly.
During his new term in office, President Roosevelt was able to get Congress to approve two major new laws. One was the Hepburn Act. This law gave the Interstate Commerce Commission power to limit how much railroads could charge for transporting goods. The purpose was to keep the cost of railroad transportation reasonable. The other new law was the Pure Food and Drug Act. This law declared it illegal to make or sell foods and medicines containing harmful chemicals. The purpose was to protect the health of all Americans.
President Roosevelt's most important foreign policy success came as a result of a war between Russia and Japan. At that time, Russia occupied Manchuria in northern China. Japan occupied Korea. Japan wanted control of Manchuria. It needed that area's coal and iron ore. Japan also wanted to end any Russian threat to Korea. So it decided to fight. Japan's navy easily defeated all the Russian fleets sent to the Pacific, but the two sides continued to fight on land. When both began to run out of money, they accepted President Roosevelt's offer to make peace.
Roosevelt invited Japanese and Russian diplomats to meet with him in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. He told them his greatest hope and prayer was for them to find a just and lasting peace quickly. A quick settlement, however, was not easy. Japan demanded $600 million for war damages. It also wanted Sakhalin Island. Russia rejected both demands. It had agreed to give up southern Manchuria. Russia would give up nothing else. Negotiations lasted many days. President Roosevelt became more and more angry when neither side would compromise. But he remained calm and kept the talks going. Later, he said, "What I really wanted to do was give an angry shout, jump up, and knock their heads together."
Finally, Roosevelt made a secret appeal to the Emperor of Japan. He asked the Emperor to drop demands for money and for Sakhalin Island. He warned that Russia was ready to fight again if the peace talks failed. The Emperor agreed to drop the demand for money, but he still demanded half of Sakhalin Island. Russia agreed to this compromise. The two sides signed a peace treaty.
Theodore Roosevelt received the Nobel Peace Prize for negotiating an end to the Russian-Japanese War. However, his efforts were denounced in Japan. Roosevelt was held responsible for the loss of war damage payments. It was money Japan needed badly. Anti-American riots broke out in some parts of the country. At the same time, tense relations developed between American citizens and Japanese immigrants in California. Poor Japanese immigrants were willing to work for low pay. As a result, Americans lost jobs. They protested. Then, school officials in San Francisco barred Japanese children from attending school with white children. President Roosevelt opposed the decision. He asked the officials to lift the ban. In exchange, he agreed to ask Japan to stop its poor farmers and laborers from going to live in America. Japan said it would. The understanding became known as the Gentleman's Agreement.
Roosevelt worked hard to improve America's relations with Japan, yet he made clear that the United States would defend its interests in Asia and the Pacific. As a warning, he sent a naval force on a voyage around the world. The force included 16 battleships and 12,000 men. It was called the Great White Fleet. The voyage lasted 14 months. The fleet sailed down the Atlantic coast of South America. It went around the bottom of South America into the Pacific Ocean, then on to Hawaii, Australia, and Japan. Surprisingly, it received its warmest welcome in Japan. An American reporter said, "The fleet made a deep and far-reaching impression. It caused the Japanese to understand the great power of the United States, as nothing else could possibly have done." President Roosevelt believed this show of American strength prevented war with Japan. "Sending out the fleet," he said, "was the most important thing I did for peace."
Theodore Roosevelt greatly enjoyed playing the part of peacemaker. After successfully ending the war between Russia and Japan, he was asked to settle another international dispute. At issue was control over Morocco.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.